Mahmud was annoyed. He'd finally gotten somebody to stop, and now his father was trying to send him away. "My house is too small for all of you," the man said. "But I have a little car dealership, and you can stay in the office."
Arabic!
Mahmud was thrilled. The man spoke fluent Arabic.
"No, no, we couldn't possibly," Mahmud's father started to say, but Mahmud cut him off.
"Yes, thank you," Mahmud cried. He waved his mother over. "He speaks Arabic, and he says he will help us." Dad tried to apologize again and refused the offer of help, but Mahmud was already climbing in the back seat with a load of life jackets. Mom got in beside him with Hannah, and Mahmud's father shifted Walid in his arms so he could reluctantly sit in the front passenger seat. "Mahmud," his father said, unhappy. But Mahmud didn't care. They were off their feet, and they were on their way to some place they could sleep. The little Skoda's gears ground as the man got them underway.
"My name is Sami Nasir," the man told them, and Mahmud's father introduced them all.
"You are Syrian, yes? Refugees?" the man asked.
"I know what it's like. I am a refugee too, from Palestine."
Mahmud frowned. This man was a refugee, and he owned his own car and his own business? "How long have you lived in Turkey?" Mahmud asked Mr. Nasir.
67 years now," Mr. Nasir said, smiling at Mahmud in the rearview mirror. "I was forced to leave my home in 1948 during the first Arab-Israeli war. They are still fighting there, but someday, when my homeland is restored, I will go home again."
Dad's phone chimed, surprising them all and making Walid stir. His father read the glowing screen.
"It's the smuggler. He says the boat is ready now."
Mahmud had learned not to get excited about these texts, but even so, he still felt a little flutter of hope in his chest.
"You take a boat to Greece tonight?" Mr. Nasir asked.
"Maybe," Mahmud's father said, "if it's there."
"I will take you to it," Mr. Nasir said. "And if it is not there, you can come back and stay with me."
"You're very kind," Mom said. Mahmud didn't know why, but his mother pulled Mahmud close and gave him a hug. It took very little time for the car to take them back to the beach, and when they pulled to a stop, they were all quiet as they stared. This time, finally, a boat was there.
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 14 days from home. A day out from Cuba, the St. Louis threw a party. Streamers and balloons hung from the ceiling and decorated the gallery rails of the first-class social hall. Chairs and tables were pushed aside to make room for dancers. There was a feeling of wild relief, as though they were dancing away all the stress of leaving Germany. The stewards smiled with the passengers, as though they understood, but none of them could really understand, Joseph thought. Not until their shop windows had been smashed and their businesses had been shut down. Not until the newspapers and radio talked about them as subhuman monsters. Not until shadowy men had burst into their homes and smashed up their things and dragged away someone they loved. Not until they had been told to leave their homeland and never, ever come back. Still, Joseph enjoyed the party. He danced with his mother while Ruthie, Renata, and Evelina ran in and out between people's legs all evening long. Joseph had been nervous about Cuba at first, scared of the unknown, but now he was excited to reach Havana, to start a new life, especially if it was like this. Joseph's father stayed hidden away in their cabin the whole night, sure this was all just another Nazi trick. The next morning, breakfast in the ship's dining room was interrupted by the thundering, clanking sound of the anchors being dropped. Joseph ran to the window. Dawn had broken, and Joseph could see the Malecón, Havana's famous seaside avenue. The stewards had told them all about its theaters and casinos and restaurants and the Miramar Hotel, where all the waiters wore tuxedos. But the St. Louis was still a long way off from there. For some reason, the ship had anchored kilometers out from shore. It's for the medical quarantine, a doctor from Frankfurt explained to the small crowd who had gathered with Joseph at the porthole to look at Cuba. I saw them run up the yellow flag this morning before breakfast. We just have to be approved by the port's medical authorities first. Standard procedure. Joseph made sure he was on deck when the first boat from the Havana Port Authority reached the St. Louis. The Cuban man who climbed the ladder to sea deck from the launch was deeply tanned and wore a lightweight white suit. Joseph watched as Captain Schroeder and the ship's doctor met the man as he came aboard. The captain swore an oath that none of the passengers was insane, a criminal, or had a contagious disease. That was apparently all that should have been required, because when the port doctor insisted he still be allowed to examine each and every passenger, Captain Schroeder looked angry. He balled his fists and breathed deeply, but he didn't object. He gave a curt order to the ship's doctor to assemble the passengers in the social hall and then marched away. Joseph ran back to his cabin and burst in on his mother packing the last of their things. Ruthie was helping her while Papa lay on the bed.
The doctor from Cuba, he's going to make all the passengers go through a medical examination, Joseph told his mother, still panting from his run. They're gathering everybody in the social hall right now.
Mama's shocked look told him she understood. Papa was not well. What if the Cuban doctor said he was too mentally disturbed to be allowed into Havana? Where would they go if Cuba turned them away? What would they do?
Gathering us? Papa said.
He looked even more frightened by the prospect than Joseph's mother had.
Like a roll call?
He stood up and backed against a wall.
No, he said. The things that happened at roll call. The hangings, the floggings, the drownings, the beatings.
He wrapped his arms around himself, and Joseph knew his father was talking about that place. Dachau. Joseph and his mother stood like statues, afraid to break the spell.
Once I saw another man shot dead with a rifle, his father whispered. He was standing right beside me. He was standing right beside me, and I couldn't move, couldn't make a sound, or I would be next.
It's not going to be like that, dear heart, Mama said. She reached out to him, tentatively, gently, and he didn't flinch under her hand. You were strong once before in that place. We just need you to be strong again, and then we'll be in Cuba. We'll be safe forever, all of us.
It was clear to Joseph that his father was still lost in his memories of Dachau as they led him to the social hall. Papa looked frightened, jittery. It scared Joseph when his father got this way, but he was even more scared that the doctor would see Papa's condition and turn them away. Joseph and his family joined the other passengers standing in rows, and the doctor walked among them. Papa stood beside Joseph, and as the doctor got closer, Joseph's father began to make a low keening sound, like a wounded dog. Papa was starting to attract the attention of the passengers around them. Joseph felt a bead of sweat roll down his back underneath his shirt, and Ruthie cried softly.
Be strong, my love, Joseph heard his mother whisper to his father. Be strong, like you were before.
But I wasn't, Joseph's father blubbered. I wasn't strong. I was just lucky. It could have been me. Should have been me.
The Cuban doctor was getting closer. Joseph had to do something.
But what? His father was inconsolable. The things he said he saw, Joseph couldn't even imagine. His father had only survived by staying quiet, by not drawing attention to himself, but now he was going to get them sent away.
Suddenly, Joseph saw what he had to do. He slapped his father across the face, hard. Papa staggered in surprise, and Joseph felt just as shocked as his father looked. Joseph couldn't believe what he'd just done. 6 months ago, he would never have even dreamed of striking any adult, let alone his father. Papa would have punished him for such disrespect. But in the past 6 months, Joseph and his father had traded places. Papa was the one acting like a child, and Joseph was the adult. Mama and Ruthie stared at Joseph, stunned, but he ignored them and pulled his father back in line.
Do you want the Nazis to catch you? Do you want them to send you back to that place? Joseph hissed at Papa.
No,
his father said, still dazed.
That man there, Joseph whispered, pointing to the doctor. He's a Nazi in disguise. He decides who goes back to Dachau. He decides who lives and who dies. If you're lucky, he won't choose you. But if you speak, if you move, if you make even the slightest sound, he will pull you out of line, send you back. Do you understand?
Joseph's father nodded urgently. Beside him, Mama put a hand to her mouth and wept, but she didn't say anything.
Now, clean yourself up. Quickly, Joseph told his father.
Aaron Landau dropped his wife's hand, dragged his oversized coat sleeve across his face, and stood rigidly at attention, eyes forward, like a prisoner. The doctor came down their row, looking at each person in turn. When he got to Papa, Joseph held his breath. The doctor looked Joseph's father up and down, then moved on. Joseph sagged with relief.
They'd made it. His father had passed the doctor's inspection.
Joseph closed his eyes and fought back tears of his own. He felt terrible for scaring his father like that, for making Papa's fears worse instead of better. And he felt terrible for taking his father's place as the man in the family. All Joseph's life, he had looked up to his father, idolized him. Now it was hard to see him as anything but a broken old man. But all that would change when they got off this ship and into Cuba. Then everything would go back to normal. They would find a way to fix his father. The Cuban doctor finished his rounds and nodded to the ship's doctor that he approved the passengers. Joseph's mother wrapped his father in a hug, and Joseph felt his heart lift. For the first time all afternoon, he felt hope.
"Well, that was a sham," said the man standing in line next to him.
"What do you mean?"
Joseph asked.
"That was no kind of medical inspection. The entire business was a charade, a giant waste of time."
Joseph didn't understand. If it wasn't a proper medical inspection, what had it all been for? He understood when he and his family lined up at the ladder on C deck to leave the ship. The Cuban doctor was gone, and he'd left Cuban police officers behind in his place. They were blocking the only way off the ship.
"We've passed our medicals, and we have all the right papers," a woman passenger said to the police. "When will we be allowed into Havana?"
"Mañana," the policeman said in Spanish. "Mañana."
Joseph didn't speak Spanish. He didn't know what mañana meant.
"Tomorrow," one of the other passengers translated for them. "Not today. Tomorrow."
Isabel. The Straits of Florida, somewhere north of Cuba, 1994. One day from home. Isabel hit the water and sank into the warm Gulf Stream. It was pitch black all around her, and the ocean was alive. Not alive with fish, alive like the ocean was a living creature itself. It churned and roiled and roared with bubbles and foam. It beat at her, pushing her and pulling her like a cat playing with the mouse it was about to eat. Isabel fought her way back to the surface and gasped for air.
"Isabel!"
her mother shrieked, her arms stretching out for her. But there was no way her mother could reach her. The boat was already so far away. Isabel panicked. How was it so far away already?
"We have to get the boat turned," Isabel heard Luis cry. "If we don't meet the waves head on, they'll roll us over."
"Dad!" Yvonne yelled.
Isabel spun in the water, and a wave slammed into her, filling her mouth and nose with salty water and sweeping her under again. The wave passed, and she broke the surface, gagging and choking, but she was already moving toward the place where she had seen Señor Castillo's head before it went under. Her hand struck something in the dark water, and Isabel recoiled until she realized it was Señor Castillo. The sea was tossing him around, but he wasn't moving on his own, wasn't fighting to get back out of the water. Isabel took in as much air as she could and dove down beneath an oncoming wave. She found Señor Castillo's body in the dark, wrapped her arms around him, and kicked as hard as she could for the surface. The ocean fought her, sweeping her legs out from under her and spinning her all around, but Isabel kicked until her lungs were about to burst, and at last she exploded up into the cold air, gasping.
There! There they are!
Ivan cried. Isabel couldn't even try to look for the boat. It was all she could do to keep Señor Castillo's lolling head above water and catch quick breaths before the waves rolled over them both. But the waves seemed to be smaller now, still deadly, but not as high and fast. Isabel began to feel the rhythm of the sea, the sing-song lullaby of it, and it was easy to close her eyes, to stop kicking, to stop fighting. She was so tired, so very, very tired. And then Ivan was there in the water with them, his arms around her, like they were back in their village playing together in the waves on the beach.
Here! Here! They're here!
Ivan shouted. Their boat was now alongside her, and her head thumped into the side of it as a wave washed over her. Hands lifted Señor Castillo from her, and soon they dragged her over the side, too. She splashed back down into the half-meter of water that filled the boat. But she was away from the waves, the never-ending waves, and she collapsed into her mother's arms.
Rudy! Rudy! Oh, God! Señora Castillo cried,
clutching her husband's hand. Señor Castillo was unconscious. Luis and Papi had laid him out on one of the benches, and Isabel's grandfather was pumping his stomach like an accordion. Seawater burbled up out of Señor Castillo's mouth, and he suddenly lurched, coughing and spluttering. Lito and Papi and Luis rolled him over, and he retched up the rest of the ocean he'd swallowed.
Rudy! Rudy!
Señora Castillo said. She wrapped him in her arms and sobbed, and then everything was quiet and still, but for the gentle lapping of the sea against the side of the boat and the sloshing of water inside it. The tanker had passed. Amara stood at the back of the boat, keeping the rudder straight against the waves. But the engine was dead again. Like everything else, it had been swamped. Señora Castillo reached for Isabel's hand and squeezed it.
Thank you, Isabel.
Isabel nodded, but it came out more like a shudder. She was freezing cold and soaked from head to toe, but at least she was back in her mother's arms. Mommy hugged her close and Isabel shivered.
We need to get the water out of the bottom of the boat,
Papi said. It was strange to Isabel to hear her father talk about something so normal, so practical, when Señor Castillo had almost drowned and the boat had almost rolled over and sunk. But he was right.
And get the engine running again, Ivan said.
The water first,
Lito agreed. And together they gathered up bottles and jugs and began the tedious work of filling them and pouring the seawater back into the ocean. Isabel stayed buried in her mother's arms, still exhausted, and no one made her get up.
Where's the box with the medicine in it?
Luis asked. There weren't too many places it could be in the small boat, and they quickly decided it must have fallen overboard in the confusion. Gone were their aspirin and bandages, and Señor Castillo was still dazed and weak. It was bad, but if they got the boat bailed out, and if they got the engine running, and if they got back on track with the sun tomorrow, and if they didn't run into any more tankers, they could make it to the States without needing the medicine or matches. If. They bailed water the rest of the night, taking turns dozing in the uncomfortable, crowded little boat. Isabel didn't even realize she'd fallen asleep until she jerked awake from a nightmare about a giant monster coming for her out of the dark sea. She cried out, looking this way and that. But there was nothing but blue-black water and gray skies tinged with the red of the sun all around them for miles and miles and miles. She closed her eyes and took deep breaths, trying to calm down. The boat rocked again, and Amara struggled to keep the rudder steady. She had taken over as pilot while Señor Castillo recovered, but they still hadn't gotten the motor running again. The Gulf Stream would carry them north, toward Florida, but they would need the engine to reach the shore. Isabel's mother leaned over the side of the boat and threw up into the sea. When she slid back down inside, she looked green. The boat was rocking so much now, Isabel couldn't sit on the bench without holding on. The waves were growing higher and higher.
"What is it?"
Ivan said sleepily.
"Another tanker?"
"No. Red sky at morning. Sailors take warning,"
Lito said, looking up into the red-tinged clouds.
"A storm is coming."
Mahmud, Izmir, Turkey, 2015. 11 days from home.
"God help us! That is what we are to ride in?" Mahmud's father said.
The boat wasn't a boat. It was a raft. A black inflatable rubber dinghy with an outboard motor on the back. It looked like there was room for 12 people in it. 30 refugees waited to get on board. They all looked as tired as Mahmud felt and wore different colored life jackets. They were mostly young men, but there were families too. Women with and without hijabs. Other children, some who looked to be about Mahmud's age. One boy in a Barcelona soccer jersey didn't have a life jacket, but clung instead to a blown-up rubber inner tube. A few of the other refugees had backpacks and plastic bags full of clothes. But most of them, like Mahmud's family, carried whatever they owned in their pockets.
"Let's go, let's go!" one of the smugglers said. 250,000 Syrian pounds, or 1,000 euros per person. Children pay full price, including babies," he told Mahmud's father.
There were two more Turks in tracksuits, like the ones who had turned them away from the mall, and they stood apart, staring at the refugees like they were something disgusting that had just washed up on the beach. Their scowls made Mahmud want to disappear again. Dad handed out their life jackets, and they put them on. Mom stared out at the black dinghy, bobbing in the gray-black Mediterranean seawater. She grabbed her husband's arm.
"What are we doing, Yusuf? Is this the right decision?"
"We have to get to Europe," he said. "What choice do we have? God will guide us."
Mahmud watched as his father pushed the cash they'd saved into the hands of one of the smugglers. Then, Mahmud and his family followed his dad to the dinghy, and they climbed on board. Walid and his mother sat down in the bottom of the dinghy, his mother holding Hana tight in her arms. Mahmud and his father sat on one of the inflated rubber edges, their backs to the sea. Mahmud was already cold, and the wind off the waves made him shiver. A big bearded man wearing a plaid shirt and a bulky blue life jacket sat down right next to Mahmud, almost squeezing Mahmud right off the edge. Mahmud slid a little closer to his father, but the big man next to him just settled into the extra space.
"How long will we be on the boat?" Mahmud asked his dad.
"Just a few hours, I think. It was hard to tell on the phone."
Mahmud nodded. The phones and chargers were safely sealed away in plastic bags in his parents' pockets, just in case they got wet. Mahmud knew because he'd been the one who had dug through the trash for the resealable zipper bags.
"We don't have to get all the way to the Greek mainland," Dad said. "Just the Greek island of Lesbos, about 100 kilometers away. Then, we're officially in Europe, and we can take a ferry from there to Athens."
When the smugglers had packed the dinghy full of refugees, they pushed it out to sea. None of the smugglers came with them. If the refugees were going to get to Lesbos, they were going to have to do it themselves.
"Does anyone know if dinner is served on this cruise?" Mahmud's father asked, and there were a few nervous laughs.
The outboard motor roared to life, and the refugees cheered and cried. Dad hugged Mahmud, then reached down to hug Mom, Walid, and Hana. They were finally doing it. They were finally leaving Turkey for Europe. Mahmud looked around in wonder. None of this seemed real. He had begun to feel like they were never going to leave. Mahmud had been so tired he could barely keep his eyes open before, but now the thrum of the motor and the chop of the boat as it hit wave after wave flooded him with adrenaline, and he couldn't have slept if he'd wanted to.
The lights of Izmir dwindled to glittering dots behind them, and soon they were out in the dark, rough waters of the Mediterranean. Phone screens glowed in the darkness, passengers checking to see if they could tell where they were. The roar of the engine and the whip-blinding sea spray made it impossible to have any kind of conversation, so Mahmoud looked around at the other passengers instead. Most of them kept their heads down and eyes closed, either muttering prayers or trying not to get sick, or both. The dinghy began to toss, not just front to back, but side to side, in a sort of rolling motion, and Mahmoud felt the bile rise in the back of his throat. On the other side of the dinghy, a man shifted quickly to vomit over the side.
"Watch out for the Coast Guard!" the big man next to Mahmoud shouted over the noise. "Turks will take us back to Turkey, but Greeks will take us to Lesbos!"
Mahmoud didn't know how anybody could see anything in the dark, cloud-covered night, but it helped his seasickness to look outside instead of inside the boat. It didn't help his growing sense of panic, though. He couldn't see land anymore, just stormy gray waves that were getting taller and narrower, like they were driving a boat through the spiky tent tops at the Kilis refugee camp. More people leaned over the side to throw up, and Mahmoud felt his stomach churn. And then the rain began. It was a hard, cold rain that plastered Mahmoud's hair to his head and soaked him down to his socks. The rain began to collect in the bottom of the dinghy, and soon Mahmoud's mother and the others were sitting in centimeters of shifting water. Mahmoud's muscles began to ache from shivering and holding the same tight position for so long, and he wanted nothing more than to get off this boat.
"We should turn back!" someone yelled. "No, we can't go back! We can't afford to try again!" Mahmoud's father yelled, and a chorus of voices agreed with him.
They pushed on through driving rain and roiling seas for what felt like an eternity. It might have been 10 hours or 10 minutes. Mahmoud didn't know. All he knew was that he wanted it to end, and end now. This was worse than Aleppo, worse than bombs falling and soldiers shooting and drones buzzing overhead. In Aleppo, at least, he could run, hide. Here, he was at the mercy of nature, an invisible brown speck in an invisible black rubber dinghy in the middle of a great black sea. If it wanted to, the ocean could open its mouth and swallow him, and no one in the whole wide world would ever know he was gone. And then, that's exactly what it did.
"I see rocks!"
someone at the front of the dinghy yelled, and there was a loud boom, like a bomb exploding, and Mahmoud went tumbling into the sea.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939. 17 days from home. A strong hand grabbed Joseph by the arm and swung him around. It was a sailor, one of the ship's firemen, and Joseph knew right away he was in trouble. The firemen were big, churlish brutes who were supposed to be on board to put out fires, but lately they'd been walking the decks, harassing the Jewish passengers. They'd been making trouble ever since the Cubans had told them they couldn't leave the ship. For 3 days the St. Louis had sat at anchor, kilometers from shore. For 3 days, while port officials came and went, the Cuban police who guarded the ladder off the ship told the passengers they couldn't leave today. "Mañana," they said. "Mañana." "Tomorrow, tomorrow." 2 days ago, the SS Orduña, a smaller English passenger liner, had arrived and anchored nearby. Joseph guessed it was one of the other two ships they'd been racing to Cuba. He and the other passengers had watched as launches went to and from the ship, as the yellow quarantine flag went up and then down. And then the Orduña had lifted anchor and cruised in to dock at the pier and let off passengers. Why had they been allowed to dock and not the St. Louis? The St. Louis had gotten there first. Captain Schroeder wasn't around to ask, and the officers and stewards had no answers for the passengers. And then today, the same thing had happened with the French ship SS Flandre. It arrived, anchored nearby, passed quarantine, docked at the Havana pier, and let off its passengers. Now it was sailing back out to sea. The passengers on the St. Louis had grown more and more restless, cornering sailors on deck and berating their stewards at dinner. Joseph had felt the tension mounting all over the ship, the pandemonium threatening to boil over every time the crew dealt with the passengers. It was as suffocating and oppressive as the 100-degree heat. Apparently, Shindik and his Nazi friends had felt the tension too, because that's when the firemen patrols had begun. It was nothing official, Joseph was sure, because the captain hadn't made an announcement. It was just certain members of the crew who had taken it upon themselves to police the ship like they were all back in Germany.
"For the safety of the Jews," Shindik told them, the same way the Gestapo took Jews into protective custody.
Another fireman stood beside the one who held Joseph's arm, blocking out the sun, and between them was Otto Shindik himself.
"Just the boy we were looking for," Shindik said. "You are to come with us."
"What? Why?"
Joseph asked, looking up at the two big men around him. Joseph felt guilty, and he was immediately mad at himself for it. Why should he feel guilty? He hadn't done anything wrong, but he remembered feeling this way back home, too, whenever he passed a Nazi on the street. In Germany, just being Jewish was a crime, and here too, apparently.
"Your parents' cabin must be searched," Shindik said. "You have a key?"
Joseph nodded, even though he didn't want to. These men were adults, and they were Nazis. One he'd been taught to respect, the other he'd learned to fear. The big fireman still had Joseph's arm, and he pulled him toward the elevator. Joseph couldn't believe he'd let himself be caught. He'd warned his little sister, Ruthie, to avoid the firemen, who loved to intimidate the children on board, and she'd managed to stay out of their way. But he'd lost himself watching the Flandre sail out of Havana Harbor, his back turned to the promenade, and that's when they'd caught him. Shindik and his firemen hustled Joseph down the stairs, and Joseph's stomach sank when they ordered him to open the door to his cabin. Joseph's hand shook as he put the key in the lock. He wished there was some way he could get out of this, some way he could keep these men away from his mother and father. Otto Shindik reached down and turned the handle for him, throwing the door open. Papa lay on a bed in his underclothes, trying to stay cool in the stifling heat. Mama sat in a chair nearby, reading a book. Ruthie, Joseph was glad to see, was still up at the pool. When she saw the men, Rachel Landau stood. On the bed, Joseph's father propped himself up, a look of panic on his face.
"What's going on here?" Mama asked. "Joseph?"
"They made me bring them here," Joseph said, his eyes wide, trying to warn her of the danger.
"Yes," Shindik said, spotting Joseph's father. "There he is."
Shindik and the two firemen stepped inside. Shindik closed the door and locked it behind them.
"For your safety, this cabin must be searched," Shindik said.
"On whose authority?" Mama asked. "Does the captain know about this?"
"On my authority," Shindik told her. "The captain has other things to worry about."
Shindik nodded, and the two firemen ransacked the room. They swept Mama's makeup and perfume off the vanity and smashed the mirror. They knocked the lamps off the bedside tables and cracked the wash basin. They opened up the family's suitcases, which were carefully packed and ready to go to Cuba, and threw their clothes all over the cabin. They tore the head off Ruthie's stuffed bunny. They snatched the book from Mama's hands and ripped out the pages, tossing them in the air like ashes from a bonfire. Joseph's mother cried out, but not so loudly that anyone else would hear. Papa wrapped himself in a ball and threw his hands over his head, whimpering. Joseph huddled against the door, angry at his helplessness, but scared that if he fought back, he'd only be punished more. When there was nothing left to smash or scatter, the fireman stood behind Shindik at the door. Shindik spat on the floor.
"That's what I think of you and your race," he said.
And suddenly Joseph understood. This was payback for his father's words to Shindik at the funeral. Shindik snorted dismissively at the cowering man on the bed.
"It's time you had your head shaved again," he told Joseph's father.
Otto Shindik let himself and the two firemen out, leaving the door wide open. Joseph's mother slid to the floor crying, and Papa blubbered on the bed. Joseph shook as he buried his face in his hands, trying to hide his own tears. He wanted nothing more than to run to his mother's arms, but she felt a million miles away from him. So did his father. They were three lonely islands, separated by an ocean of misery. Of all the things Shindik and his firemen had broken, the Landau family was the one thing Joseph wasn't sure they could put back together.
"You said if I was quiet, if I stood very still, they wouldn't come for me," Papa said.
It took Joseph a moment to realize his father was talking to him. Joseph's breath caught. His father was talking about the medical inspection. When Joseph had scared his father to get him to straighten up. Papa looked up at him, his eyes red from crying.
"You said they wouldn't come for me. You said they wouldn't send me back. You promised, and they came for me anyway."
Joseph felt like his father had slapped him, even though Papa hadn't touched him. Joseph reeled. He backed into his mother's little makeup table, and one of the bottles Shindik hadn't smashed rolled off and shattered on the floor beside him. Joseph didn't even jump. He had lied to his father, betrayed him, made him think he was back at that awful place, terrified him all over again. But that wasn't the worst thing he had done. Joseph had made his father a promise he couldn't keep.
Isabel, somewhere on the streets of Florida, 1994. 2 days from home. Rain lashed Isabel as she shoveled water out of the boat. Scoop, pitch. Scoop, pitch. The bottom of the boat filled as fast as they could bail it out. Isabel, her mother, her father, her grandfather, Luis, Iván, Señora Castillo, they all worked feverishly, none of them talking. Not that they could hear each other over the storm. The only ones not bailing were Señor Castillo, who looked like a ghost, and Amara, who clung to the rudder with white-knuckled hands and tried to keep the boat turned into the churning waves so it wouldn't capsize. The engine hadn't worked since their escape from the tanker. The storm clouds turned the day into night, and the driving rain soaked Isabel to the bone. She shivered in the cold wind, her feet numb in the water sloshing at the bottom of the boat. Sea spray stung her eyes, and in between scoops of water, she dragged her arm across her face, trying to wipe away the saltwater tears. As she watched the surging waves, Isabel remembered the last time she had seen her abuelita, her grandma. She remembered Lita's hand reaching out for help as the tide swept her away. Isabel had been 9 years old. Her parents had sent her to stay with Lito and Lita in their little shack on the coast. They hadn't said why, but Isabel was old enough to know her parents had been fighting again, and they wanted to be alone while they worked things out. All that spring, Isabel had waded without joy in the ocean, waiting for the storm to come that would tear her family apart. And then the real storm had come. It wasn't a hurricane. It was bigger than a hurricane. A gigantic cyclone that stretched from Canada, down through the United States and across Cuba, and into Central America. Later, they would call it the storm of the century, but to Isabel, it was the storm. The shrieking wind ripped roofs off houses and pulled palm trees straight out of the ground. The rain fell sideways. Hail shattered windows like a never-ending shotgun blast. And the ocean. The ocean rose up like a giant hand and reached inland, over Lito and Lita's little house by the sea, smothering the house in its giant paw and dragging the shattered pieces back into its lair. Lito and Lita hadn't known the storm was coming, or they wouldn't have been there. They would have been inland, found higher ground. Castro had promised he would protect them, but he didn't. Not then. Not Isabel's grandmother. Lito had been able to hold on to Isabel, but Lita had been swept away. She had slipped under the waves, her arms still reaching for Lito, for Isabel. And that was the last they had ever seen of her. Lito's arm found Isabel again now, and wrapped her in a hug.
I know what you're thinking,
he said close to her ear where she could hear him.
I'm thinking about it too.
I miss her, Isabel told her grandfather.
I miss her too,
Lito said.
Every day.
Real tears came into Isabel's eyes now, and Lito hugged her tighter.
That was her song's end,
Lito whispered.
But ours plays on. Come, keep bailing, or soon it'll be up to our eyeballs.
Isabel nodded and went back to scooping water. What if her life was a song? No, not a song. A life was a symphony, with different movements and complicated musical forms. A song was something shorter, a smaller piece of a life. This journey was a song, Isabel realized, a son cubano, and each part of it was a verse. The first verse had been the riot, a blast of trumpets, the rat-a-tat-tat of a snare drum. Then the pre-chorus of trading her trumpet for gasoline, the piano that gave the son its rhythm, and then the chorus itself, leaving home. They were still leaving home, still hadn't gotten to where they were going. They would return to the chorus again and again before they were done. But what was the refrain? And how many more verses would there be before they got to the climax of the song, that brash moment at the end of a son cubano that echoed the refrain, and then the coda, those brief few notes that tied it all together? She couldn't think about that now. All she could do now was scoop water. Scoop water and pray they didn't drown in the mad conga solo that drummed against the side of their tiny metal boat.
Mahmoud, somewhere on the Mediterranean Sea, 2015, 11 days from home. The cold water was like a slap in Mahmoud's face. Before he could think, he gasped, sucking in a mouthful of the dark Mediterranean Sea. He tumbled backward, head down in the murky water, his arms and feet thrashing, trying to right himself. Something else, someone else, fell on top of him, pushing him deeper down into the water. He choked, coughed, swallowed more water. Bodies tumbled into the water above him, beside him, below him. His knee struck something hard and sharp, a rock, and he felt a cold flash of pain that quickly disappeared into blind, senseless terror. He was drowning. The rubber dinghy had burst against the rocks, and he was drowning. Mahmoud kicked, paddled, flailed. His face came out of the water, and he gulped down air, and then a wave washed over him again, and he went down. He kicked his way back to the surface and fought to keep his head above water.
Mom! Dad! Mahmoud cried.
His yells were mixed with the screams and cries of the other passengers who made it back to the surface. All around Mahmoud, survivors thrashed and gasped, swamped by the choppy waves. There was nothing left of the dinghy. The engine had dragged the rest of it down. Mahmoud saw something bobbing along the water, glowing. A cell phone. It was still sealed tight in its plastic bag, the air in the bag keeping it afloat. Mahmoud swam for it, ducking a wave and pawing the bag into his arms. The glowing phone screen said 2:32 a.m.
Help! Help!
Mahmoud's mother sobbed, her voice recognizable in the chaos. Mahmoud spun, oriented himself, and frog-kicked his way through the waves toward the shape he thought was his mother. He picked her pink headscarf out of the swirling pandemonium and saw that she was fighting to lift something up out of the water. Hana. Mahmoud swam to his mother. Hana was crying. She was alive! But it was all Mahmoud's mother could do to keep the baby and her own face above the relentless waves. One or the other of them was going to drown. Mahmoud put his arms around his mother and tried to kick her and Hana both to the surface, but half the time he felt like he was dragging them down with him.
Fatima! Mahmoud!
He heard his father cry. Mahmoud turned to see his father with Walid in his arms.
The life preservers are useless! He roared,
his head appearing and disappearing behind the waves.
They're fakes!
fake! Mahmoud was furious, but his anger quickly faded. Every ounce of his energy was focused on kicking, swimming. If he stopped, he and his mother and sister would drown. There were other people around them, yelling, searching, fighting to stay afloat. But as far as Mahmoud was concerned, his world was 4 meters round. Where did they go from here? How did they get out of the sea and onto dry land? They were lost in the stormy Mediterranean Sea in the middle of the night. Their dinghy was sunk, and though it had run into rocks, there wasn't any land in sight. They were going to die here, all of them. Mahmoud breathed in seawater through his nose and hacked it up. He fought to breathe, the waves lapping over him, and rain and spray still lashing his face. But his baby sister's cries refocused him. He could not lose her. He couldn't lose any of them. They came together in the water, Mahmoud and his mother and father, all of them helping Hana and Walid and each other stay afloat. Other families and groups did the same, but eventually the little groups drifted apart from each other, none of them knowing which way they were supposed to go. All they could do was stay on top of the next wave, the next wave, the next wave. "Kick off your shoes," Mahmoud's father told them. "Anything to lighten you." Time passed. The rain stopped. The waxing moon even peeked out from behind a cloud. But just as quickly it was dark again, and the cold wind and the salty spray and the swelling sea still tormented them. Mahmoud's legs were numb with cold and exhaustion. They felt like two lead weights he struggled to lift and churn to stay afloat. His mother had been quietly sobbing for what seemed like forever. Her arms no longer held Hana above the water, but just on top of it, like she was pushing along a tiny barge. Mahmoud's father did the same with Walid, trying to save his strength. Hana had gone as quiet as Walid, and Mahmoud wondered if they were still alive. He couldn't ask, wouldn't. If he didn't ask, he couldn't know for sure, and as long as he didn't know for sure, there was a chance they were still alive. Mahmoud slipped beneath the waves once more, longer this time. It was getting so hard to come up again, to keep himself afloat. He rose again, pushing air out of his nose, but he was tired. So very, very tired. He wished for a respite from swimming, just a moment to sit without working his arms and legs, to close his eyes and go to sleep. Water was sloshing in and out of Mahmoud's ears, but he thought he heard a drone just above the howl of the wind. In Syria, that sound would have sent him ducking for cover, but now it made his eyes widen, his legs kick just a little harder, a little higher. There! Coming at them out of the darkness! Another dinghy full of people! Mahmoud and his mother and father waved their arms and cried out for help. At last the people on board saw them, but as the dinghy came closer, it didn't slow down. They weren't going to stop! The front of the dinghy chopped past Mahmoud, and he lunged for one of the handholds on the side. He caught it and grabbed his mother before the dinghy pulled him away. He swung Mom to the side of the dinghy, and she grabbed hold, the wake from it almost swamping Hana. Behind them, Mahmoud's father also reached for the dinghy, but missed. It churned along, bouncing in the chop, and Mahmoud's father and brother disappeared into the darkness. "Dad! Dad!" Mahmoud cried, still holding on to the dinghy. "Let go!" a woman in the dinghy yelled down at him. "You're dragging on us!" "Let us in, please!" Mahmoud begged. It was all his mother could do to hang on to the dinghy and to Hana.
"We can't! There's no room!"
a man inside the dinghy yelled.
"Please!" Mahmoud begged. "We're drowning!"
"I'll call the Coast Guard for you," a man said. "I have their number on my phone."
Another man reached down and tried to pry Mahmoud's hands from the dinghy.
"You're tipping us!"
"Please!"
Mahmoud cried. He sobbed with the effort of fighting off the man's fingers and hanging on to the dinghy.
"Please! Take us with you!"
"No! No room!"
"At least take my sister!" Mahmoud begged. "She's a baby! She won't take up any room!"
That caused much yelling and discussion on the boat. A man tried to pry Mahmoud loose again, but he hung on,
"Please!"
Mahmoud begged. A woman appeared at the side of the boat, her arms reaching down to Mahmoud's mother, reaching for the baby. Mahmoud's mother lifted the little ball of wet blankets up to the woman.
"Her name is Hannah,"
she said, struggling to be heard above the roar of the engine and the splash of the waves. Someone finally pried Mahmoud's fingers off the side, and he slipped into the water and tumbled in the dinghy's wake. When he came up, he saw his mother had let go of the dinghy too. She was crying, great howling tears, and tearing at her clothes. Mahmoud swam over to her and wrestled her hands into stillness, and she put her head on Mahmoud's shoulder and sobbed. Mahmoud's sister was gone, and so were his father and brother.
Joseph. Just outside Havana Harbor, 1939, 18 days from home. Joseph tried to hang on to the chair, but his father was still strong enough to yank it out of his hands. Papa stacked it on the tower of furniture he'd already piled up against the door. "We can't let them back in," Papa cried. "They'll come for us again and take us away." It had taken Joseph and his mother a night and a day to put their cabin back together after Otto Schindick and his goons had torn the place up. But in the span of 15 minutes, his father had undone it all again, snatching up anything that wasn't nailed down and stacking it against the door. Ruthie crouched in the corner, crying and hugging Bitsy. Joseph's mother had sewed the stuffed bunny back together first thing, before Ruthie had seen it headless.
"Aaron! Aaron!" Joseph's mother said now. "You have to calm down. You're scaring your daughter."
He was scaring Joseph, too. Joseph stared at his father. This skeleton, this crazed ghost, this wasn't his father. The Nazis had taken his father away and replaced him with a madman.
"You don't understand," Joseph's father said. "You can't know what they did to people, what they'll do to us."
Papa threw an open suitcase on the pile, spilling clothes all over the room. When he'd put everything he could on the barricade, he crawled under the desk at the back of the room, like a child playing hide-and-seek. Mama looked frightened as she tried to figure out what to do.
"Ruthie," she said at last, "put your swimsuit on and go to the pool."
"I don't want to go swimming,"
Ruthie said, still crying in the corner.
"Do as I say," Mama said.
Ruthie pulled herself away from the wall and picked through the clothes on the floor for her swimsuit.
"Joseph," Mama said, low enough for just him to hear her, "I'm going to go to the ship's doctor for a sleeping draught for your father, something to calm him. I'll take Ruthie to the pool, but I need you to stay here and watch your father."
Papa was still curled into a ball under the desk, rocking and muttering to himself. The idea of being here alone with him filled Joseph with dread.
"But if the doctor knows he's unwell, they might not let us into Cuba," Joseph whispered, desperate to find some reason to keep his mother with him. "I'll tell the doctor I'm anxious and haven't been sleeping," Mama said. "I'll tell him the draft is for me."
Joseph's mother helped Ruthie finish putting her swimsuit on, and together they were able to pull the haphazard pile of furniture far enough away from the door to open it. Joseph's father, who had been so set on building the barricade just minutes before, was so lost in his own mind he didn't even notice. Joseph didn't know what to do with himself, so he started to put the room back together. Papa stayed quiet and still under the desk. Joseph hoped he had gone to sleep. Mama came back within minutes, and Joseph felt an immense sense of relief. Until he saw the dull, panicked look Mama wore, and he got scared all over again. She stumbled as she entered the cabin, like she couldn't remember how to walk, and Joseph hurried to help her to one of the beds.
"Mama, what is it? What's wrong?" Joseph asked.
I told the doctor the sleeping draught was for me," she said, her words slow. "And he made me take it right there."
"You drank it?"
Joseph said. His mother's eyelids fluttered.
"I had to," she said. After I told him, couldn't let him know Aaron was really the one who..."
Mama's eyelids closed, and she swayed. Joseph panicked. She couldn't go to sleep. Not now. How was he supposed to take care of his father? He couldn't do this alone.
Mama, don't go to sleep.
Her eyes jerked open again, but they had lost their focus.
Your sister, she said. Don't forget. Your sister. She's at the pool.
Her eyes flickered closed again, and she rolled back onto the bed.
No, 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 no,
Joseph said. He tried patting his mother on the cheeks to wake her up, but she was out cold. Joseph got up and paced the room, trying to think. With his mother asleep, he had to watch his father every second. Joseph glanced at him under the desk. Papa was quiet now, but the slightest thing could set him off. Joseph couldn't go for help anyway. If anyone knew his father was unwell, he'd be barred from entering Cuba. But Joseph also had to go get Ruthie at some point and make sure she got dinner and was put to bed. Suddenly, Joseph was the man of the family, the only adult in the family, whether he wanted to be or not.
"Have you ever seen a man drown?"
Papa asked in a whisper, and Joseph jumped. Joseph wasn't sure if Papa was talking to him or just talking, but he was afraid to answer, afraid to break the quiet spell his father was under. His father kept talking.
After the evening roll call, they would choose someone to drown. One every night. They would tie his ankles together and his hands behind his back and tie a gag around his mouth, and then they would hang him upside down with his head in a barrel. Like a fish. Like a big fish on the pier, hanging upside down by its tail. Then they would fill the barrel with water. Slowly, so they could enjoy the panic, so they could laugh. And then the water would rise high enough to cover his nose, and he would breathe in the water because there was nothing else he could do. He would breathe in water like a fish. Only he wasn't a fish. He was a man. He would thrash around and breathe water until he drowned upside down.
Joseph's breathing.